Very good evening. Greet you on the blessed name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Well, I'm sure we all want meaning in life. We don't want to, you know, go through a whole life of labor, of hard work, of putting our heart and soul into all the things that we do. And then at the end of it all, we just look back and say, well, what's the point of it all? What have I accomplished? What have I done with my life? And through the course of our life, we want meaning. We want fulfillment. We want to see that our labors, our efforts, the life that we live and the things that we do, it counts for something. I'm sure that's the desire of all our hearts. None of us want to live a wasted life. None of us want to be seen as that useless person, that good-for-nothing person. All of us want to be valued. We want meaning. And to an extent, all of us are still, we are searching, right? Not still searching, but we are searching. To varying degrees, we have found meaning in the things that we do. But the question then begs is, really, what does meaning mean? Or where is meaning really to be found? Because you go out into the world and you ask them this question, now, what is the meaning of life? Or where can we really find meaning and fulfillment in what do we do? And there's going to be a whole myriad of a variety of answers, right? Of course, we know the textbook Christian answer, right? We all know, well, we're supposed to bring glory to God. We're supposed to live our lives for God. But then out there in the world, there's so many different opinions, isn't it? Well, the meaning of life is about enjoying your life. Oh, the meaning of life is about doing good. Oh, the meaning of life is about helping others. And so forth, and the list goes on. But then the thing about it is, on one hand, we have the Christian opinion. On the other hand, we have the worldly advice. And a lot of us fall somewhere in between. We know the textbook answer, but is that really our final conclusion? Is that really the meaning that we are really seeking after? Or are we still searching? Are we still looking for that elusive thing which can find us the greatest enjoyment, the greatest excitement, the greatest fulfillment in our lives? Now, that was the situation that Solomon found himself in. I believe we already went through the introduction in chapter 1. And he started his quest and this search for wisdom, right, as we saw in chapter 1. He was going around, and as what we'll see in these first two chapters is the different avenues in which he went down. Well, he thought to himself, well, maybe let's give my heart to seek and search after wisdom concerning all the things that are done under the heavens. Basically, he was looking for worldly wisdom, the worldly knowledge, the knowledge of all the things in this world, thinking that if I study and I study very hard and I go into all these different fields, I get multiple PhDs, well, maybe my life will be complete. And of course, the conclusion of that was that, well, this is vexation of spirit. Much study is just a weariness of flesh. That was chapter 1. In chapter 2, we're going to see him exploring other different avenues. And these avenues, you may say, these different facets of life in which he thought could give him meaning are really going to be quite familiar to us. Because these are things which I'm sure at some point of time in our life, we tried it. Some of us are still trying it. Some of us are still exploring, and some of us are still caught in the lie that tells us that maybe this is what will grant you fulfillment in your life. And of course, we know his conclusion. That at the end of it all, it's just really, again, vanity and vexation of spirit. But nonetheless, he tried. As we know, Solomon wrote this at the tail end of his life, after he had repented, after he had turned back to the Lord. And he was writing this as a sort of reflection, telling us, now, please don't go this way. This was what I did. This is what I tried. There was no fulfillment. Don't go the same way that I did. But nonetheless, what we see in this chapter, at least in the first 11 verses, is another aspect of his search. And what we can call this really the search of a carnal man. Right, how a carnal man will go around in this world trying to seek and find fulfillment in his life. It's quite a long chapter to cover, and so we'll go through this quite quickly. And again, as I said, this is really not unfamiliar to many of us. So what he tried to do? We see a variety of things which he described in chapter 2. And so he says, now I sit in my heart. Now he realized that as he went about this search, it was quite a deliberate one. He was no fool. We know that Solomon was the wisest man, or one of the wisest men to have ever lived. And he was always, you can say, in control of his mind, in control of his thinking. He was a deep thinker, and he always considered everything that he did. And it was a deliberate thing. So he said, well, I first gave my heart to seek and search after wisdom. That didn't work. All right, now what do I do? Chapter 2, he says, I will prove with mirth, enjoy pleasure. That's one thing. Thinking that, well, maybe pleasure is what we ought to seek for in this life. And very quickly, he gives us the conclusion. Well, it is vanity. Emptiness is the meaning of the word vanity. It's just nothing. What did it accomplish? I said of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, what doeth it? Or rather, what does it accomplish? Very quickly, he found out and he realized that now pleasure doesn't get you anywhere, right? And the pleasure that we're talking about here, of course, is temporal pleasure. Just a momentary sort of enjoyment. Laughter, jokes, fun, revelry. He says, well, what did it accomplish? And that's quite true, isn't it? Amusements, what are they? What does it accomplish? Yeah, for a period of time, we have fun. We watch a television show, we laugh and we laugh and laugh for 20 minutes, half an hour. A movie, we just watch a comedy. Oh, we feel good for that period of time. By the end of it, what do you accomplish? What? Do you even remember the things that you laughed about? And so he says, well, I tried to enjoy, but really it came to not much. And in a sense, this is a sort of a summary statement of all the other things that he's going to talk about in this particular chapter. Of mirth, of laughter, of enjoyment, of pleasure. This is all these things of the flesh really didn't seek to please me. And so what else do you do? Verse 3. Talked about pleasure. He talked about what we can call partying, right? I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine. And I'm sure there's something we're all pretty familiar with. Something that was practiced in the past, something that continued to be practiced throughout the ages, even until now. I'm sure it doesn't require too much explanation, isn't it? What was luxury then, what was their sort of enjoyment, is really the sort of things that we continue to do right now, only much worse, isn't it? Stronger, because our science and our technology has allowed refinement of alcohol to such a high and strong degree. But yet it was the same thing, isn't it? He says, I sought in my heart. Again, it was a deliberate action that he took to give myself unto wine. He says, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom. Now, what does that mean? What we realize, especially throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, is that when he uses the word wisdom, you must understand it in its context. Not all wisdom that he talks about is the same. Because much later on in the book, right, from chapter 7 onwards, he will say, well, seek the better things. And then he talks about seeking wisdom. And he talks about the value of wisdom. But earlier on in the book, you realize that the wisdom or the flavor of wisdom he's talking about here is really the wisdom of the world, simply just describing his intellect, his intelligence. That's it, right? Because if you read the book of Kings and you look at the sort of wisdom that is being described of Solomon there, you realize that it was not godly wisdom in the sense of being a godly person, having discernment, making right choices, right? He was endowed with intellect and special skill to be able to conduct himself well as a king. I remember his testimony. He talked about how the Lord appeared to him. He prayed. He says, I'm young. I don't know how to rule a kingdom. And then God gave him that sort of wisdom. Okay, you study the book of 1 Kings carefully and realize that, well, that is what Solomon had. Intellect. Okay? He was an extremely brilliant, intelligent, smart person. And so what he means here is that, well, as I went to drink, how do you acquaint yourself with wisdom as you drink? You know that's not godly wisdom, right? He's talking about the fact that he continued to be in control of his senses. Maybe he didn't get extremely drunk. He still knew what he was doing. It was still a sort of intellectual search. But it was like an experiment, right? He looked out into the world and he looked at the people in the inns and the taverns. And he looked at them drinking, partying, reveling. And he thought, hey, that looks quite interesting. That looks quite exciting. Maybe I'll give it a try. Maybe I'll just go into the club once, twice at the bars. I look at the way that they seem to just drink all their cares and worries away. Maybe I should try it for once. And so that's what he did. But yet he described this as trying to lay hold on folly. It's quite an interesting expression, isn't it? What does it mean to lay hold on folly? To lay hold on means what? To grasp, or even to harness or control for yourself. Folly? Foolishness? How do you harness foolishness? But that was his description of drinking while continuing to retain his intellect. He's trying to grasp something which he knew he couldn't control. And so he says that was what it was. I tried to give myself the wine to just drink like the people of the world drink, but it was foolishness. It's like trying to tame foolishness. You can't do that. He says, I tried to see until I know what is like good for the sons of men, the people of the earth. They seem to find it good and enjoyable. I tried to understand, but really, at the end of it all, it was nothing. Vanity, vexation of spirit. Because he says now, in retrospect, of course, that these are the things which they do under the heaven all the days of their life. Now, it's another phrase that you're going to see throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Under the sun, under the heavens. What does that mean? It's talking about temporal things that you do on this earth. Under the realms of the heaven, under eternity, which is, well, up there. Right? Anything under the sun that talks about this realm on earth. Everything that we do focus on the temporal things. He says, well, that's what the sons of men do. All the days of their life, they just try to drink their worries and their cares away. They just party, engage in mirth and pleasure and enjoyment. He says, I tried to be like that. And I was in it for a long time, he says. But yet at the end of the day, at the end of it all, vanity. All right, so that's the first two things. He sought after pleasure. He sought after partying. Didn't work. Next thing, the long list that we see from verse 4 onwards is, you can describe all his possessions and his pride. He had a lot of building projects. Verse 4, I made me great works. I built me houses. I planted me vineyards. And it's not just a house. He had many houses. And I mean, property today is such a sought after thing, isn't it? Solomon, he had it all. He was the richest man in Jerusalem at the point of time. He was the king. And not only that, it was backed by the immense intellect. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he was extremely successful in every field that he placed his hand into. In a sense, in the eyes of the world, a greatly enviable position that he was in. I mean, basically, he had everything that he ever wanted. Houses, plenty, right? If you examine, again, 1 Kings, and you study the temple of the Lord that he built, and then after the house that he built for himself, almost every single dimension of his house was larger than the house of the Lord. He spent far more years building his own house than he built the house of the Lord. He had great, great works, great houses, vineyards, gardens, orchards, and I planted trees in them, all kinds of fruits. He was involved in horticulture. He was involved in farming. He was quite a keen agriculturalist. And he was successful. He even devised this sort of irrigation system you see in verse 6. I made me pools of water to water therewith, the wood that brought forth trees. He devised a system in which all these plants would be well watered. A greatly intelligent man. Successful in the fields of engineering, of agriculture, of architecture, of everything that we in the world seek after. Then he was rich. Go down the list, verse 7. I got me servants and maidens. And I had servants born in my house. It's not just a few servants. Some of us here, we have them. But he had households of servants, such that there were servants, and they had servants who were children, and they continued to be his servants. And also I had possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. An extremely rich man. Everything that he wanted, he had. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasures of kings and of provinces. He was rich in material possessions, silver and gold, and not just that, all these precious artifacts, precious objects, jewels, gems, things from all around the region. The nations around him, they came to listen to his wisdom and they paid tribute to him. But again, you can read this in 1 Kings. They were so impressed with his intellect and the way in which he managed his kingdom. They all just flocked to see him. And as they came, they bought gifts, all sorts of precious things, right? Sometimes we go around the world and we buy things and we place it, display it around our house. Well, these are little trophies that we have of our world travels. Solomon didn't have to do that. It came to him. And it was not just the things that you buy in the cheaply off the bazaar on the streets. No, it was the kings that gave it to him. The leaders of the land. The most precious, the most valuable. He had it. He had it. And then he had, well, you can see an entertainment system, isn't it? We spend thousands and hundreds of thousands on a home stereo system, a hi-fi set. What do you have? He had live entertainment. I got singers, women singers, and all the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments and of the, all that sorts. Basically, it's a listing of all his accomplishments, his possessions, everything that the world wanted, he had it. And we look at this sort of list sometimes and we think, oh, how good, isn't it? If only I had these things as well. If only I had the money to afford it, right? Whatever what we are interested in, whatever hobby that we pursue, whatever, you know, really that we desire, he had it. Everything. Everything. And we look at him and, yeah, we say, yeah, he's a carnal man. He's an he's ungodly at this point of time in his life. But yet in our own lives, these are the things that we pursue after as well, isn't it? Sometimes we think that these are the things that can find, that can give me meaning as well. And we spend so much time, so much effort pursuing after all these things. Well, Solomon wrote this to us, not so that we can be envious of him and say, oh, how I wish I had these things. No, he wrote it to us to tell us that this is really not what we ought to seek after. Because he would then go on to tell us that this really did not bring meaning to him at all. Right? So he was rich and he was great. Verse 9. You can call this the pursuit of pride as well, isn't it? We pursue after possessions. We pursue after pride and accomplishments. We want to be great in the eyes of the world. Sometimes, you know, the pursuit of all these possessions is not so much that we really want it for ourselves. But it's more about the perception that people have of us. To show to the people around us that we have made it in life. We are there. We are successful. We have it made. And for Solomon, that was so true. And he says, so I was great. And he truly was great. Not just great in eyes of his own kingdom, but all the nations around him acknowledged that truly Solomon is great. You remember the Queen of Sheba? She traveled from a long way out because she didn't believe all the stories that she heard about the greatness of his wisdom. And then she traveled all the way there and then she concluded at the end of it, yet, you know, all the stories are true. And instead, it is far more true now I see it in person. You really are a wise person. But of course, it's not a good testimony that he had. It's not the sort of wisdom that he wrote off way back in the time when he wrote Proverbs, not that wisdom. It was just intellect, skill, ability to control his people, his kingdom. And so this sort of greatness is really not the greatness that we want to seek after. It's not the greatness that brings us meaning in life. But nonetheless, that was the sort of reputation that he had for himself. I increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. And also my wisdom remained with me. And look at verse 10. And whatsoever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from many joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. This was my portion of all my labor. What a life, isn't it? Imagine if this was allowed for you. Whatever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. He had no limitations, basically. In terms of money, he had it. In terms of power, he had it. Whatever he wanted, he took. Imagine that from all morning onwards, you open the newspaper, you see every single advertisement that's pictured there. Property here, property in London, in Australia. You look at all the classified ads, you look at all the cars for sale, you look at all the bungalows for sale. Whatsoever my eyes desire, I kept it not from them. You open your bank account, you realize there's more numbers than you can ever number, right? And there's basically no law. You just want anything, you just take. It's yours. That was the sort of life that Solomon had. Anything, everything. And that included wives as well. You remember his harem of women that he had? 7,000 wives, 300 concubines. And I'm sure that is involved, right? Included, right? Whatever my eyes desire. Oh, okay. I won. I imagine that in just weddings alone, to get 1,000 of them, you need to have a wedding every day for 3 years. He had that. And sometimes probably he didn't even have a wedding. Put her in my harem. Anything he wants, well, that was his life. That was a life which so many of us crave, isn't it? Thinking that, oh, if I earn enough money, well, I can have that level of enjoyment. I can have that level of fulfillment and meaning in my life. And many people out there in the world, that's all they want. To have the ability to say that whatever my eyes desire, I keep not from it. I withheld not my heart from many joy. No morals, no limitations, no restrictions, no law. Whatever I want, I take. And so he says, at that point of time, my heart rejoiced in all my labor. He says, I earned it. I worked hard. I was a good king. I was a responsible king. He works, right? It's not that he was derelict in his duty and he just left his kingdom to ruins, no. He managed his kingdom well. He pursued after all these different hobbies and enjoyments and luxuries that he sought after. And he says, at that point of time, yes, my heart rejoiced. I was, well, happy for a season. But then look what happens in verse 11. Then I looked at all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I labored to do, and behold, what? All was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Basically, after going through all these things, he came a point of time in his life where he looked back at everything that he accomplished. And then he asked the question, what's the point? What's the point? All right, I got all these things. All right, I got many houses. I got many wives. I got so much wealth, so much treasures. But what's the point? Where is the meaning, the true meaning and the true fulfillment? It still eluded him. He said it was just empty. It just brought vexation to his spirit. And he realized deep down inside, because he was at the end of the day still a believer, isn't it? Deep down inside, he says, well, actually, it doesn't mean anything at all. He is no prophet, as I said earlier, under the sun, meaning in this realm, in this present temporal physical earth. He says, no use, no point, no fulfillment. And so that was his search as a carnal man. You know, if you read from verse 1, you can say rather from verse 4 down to verse 10, it seems like an excellent dream description of a life. But it's only from when you read from verse 12 onwards, then you are faced with the stark reality of how meaningless these carnal pursuits are. So at first, you can say it's the search for meaning of a carnal man. But then he came upon a single thought. One thought that then suddenly just changed his perspectives all totally, completely. And that was a reminder of death. And what you can entitle the next few verses, from verse 12 all the way down to verse 23, the search of a dying man. Of a dying man. Probably this happened later on in his life, as he aged, as he got older, as he began to realize that, you know, a lot of these things really don't mean anything anymore. What's the point of silver and gold? What's the point of all these houses and servants and all these things? What's the point if I know that one day I'm going to die? And as he thought upon this, as he latched upon this thought of dying, suddenly everything that he was secure and comfortable and happy in was all thrown into turmoil. He began to grieve and he began to despair. And let's read on. He says, I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man that do that cometh after the king, even that which had been already done? Now he looks back and he reflects, all right, about the things that he had been doing, all these searches that he had had for meaning. He looks back at what he described in chapter 1. I tried to seek after wisdom. I tried to seek after mirth and pleasure and luxuries. And he says, really, I mean, I have done whatever I can do as the king, as this powerful, intelligent person. What else can man do more than what I have done? And well, the answer is really, it was really a rhetorical question. Nobody could have exceeded him in seeking after wisdom and all these different things. And well, he admits to an extent, well, it's true that wisdom is useful. Verse 13, I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. Yes, wisdom is useful to an extent. I mean, of course, it's better to be a clever person than a stupid person, right? I mean, everyone acknowledged that. Well, you know, continue to make mistakes and make foolish choices and silly choices in life. Nobody wants that. Yeah, so wise man's eyes are in his head. Basically, he's describing how he walks around with discernment, right? He looks at where he's going, and so his eyes are in his head. But the fool, he walks like a blind person, stumbling around in the darkness, making mistakes, fumbling. But then he says, I myself perceive that one event happeneth to them all. And what is this event? Is the idea of his impending death. Then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so happeneth even to me. And by me, men, or me, as the wise person. And I'm so intellectual, I'm so clever, I'm so accomplished in this life, I have so many things. And this fool, he did nothing in his life, but yet, we're all going to end up in the same place. We're all going to die one day. And what's the point? He says, it's vanity, isn't it? Both our lives are going to end in the exact same way. We're going to die. We're going to end up in the grave. And then what's the point? How will my houses help me? How will my servants help me? How will my gold and silver and all the treasures that I've amassed, how will that help me? Because both of us are going to die. And then he thought, verse 16, there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. Who will remember me? Who will remember the fool? Nobody. Who will remember me, the rich and intelligent and wise person? Well, maybe there's a little bit more mention, but again, not much, isn't it? Because he thought back at the people that had died before him and he realized that after they go to the grave, yeah, they may mourn for a while. There may be even a statue or memorial erected in his honor, but that's it. Over time, they'll be forgotten. And what's the point? And what's the point, isn't it? You see, the reason why he came to such a conclusion at that point of time in his life, because he was still carnal. He was still just fixated on the temporal, physical things of the earth. He was a man living under the sun. God was not in the picture in his life. Although he had known God in his youth, his father David, I'm sure, would have taught him well. But he had backslidden to such an extent that God was just simply not in the picture. And so as a dying man, as he considered the fact that I'm going to leave this earth soon, and well, what is it of all my gold and my treasure, my silver and all my accomplishments? It means nothing because nobody's going to remember me. And seeing that that which now is in the days to come shall be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man as the fool? Death is the same to all, isn't it? We're all going to have to leave this earth one day and then nothing. Nothing. At least for him at that point of time, that's what he thought. And what was the result of this verse 17? Very, very tragic for a believer to say such a thing, isn't it? Verse 17. He says, therefore, I hated life. He hated the life that he had. I mean, what sort of life was it? It was the life that we saw being described from verse 4, isn't it? The life of plenty, of luxury, of all the things that the people of the world wish and desire for. He says, I hated it. A strong word to use, isn't it? To look at your life and everything that you have and you say, what's the point? I'm going to die one day. And I'm going to be just like the fool. What's the point of living? Truly, you know, at this point of time, he still hadn't found meaning at all. He was still lost. He was still out there in the world. He was still living a godless life. And as a dying man or a person thinking of his death, he says, well, life holds no meaning for me. Why? Because that work which is wrought under the sun, all these temporal things which I've been pursuing after, it's grievous unto me. And it is all emptiness, it is all vanity, it is all just vexation of the spirit. And he goes even deeper into misery. You can read on in verse 18. Then he says, I hated life, and then I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, the works of my hands. All the things that we read of earlier in the chapter, he says, I hated it. I despised it. The things which I used to, you know, engage myself in with such passion and vigor, thinking that this is what really will bring me enjoyment and fulfillment, he says, I hated it now. I looked at all my houses, and he would have taken a walk around his vineyards and orchards. And then he looked, and the more he saw, the more grief it brought him. The more he despaired. Because he says, well, these were all just my labors under the sun. Why? Because I'm so worried, I'm going to leave it to someone else. Someone else is going to come and then take control of all my possessions, of my whole kingdom, of all my wealth. And I don't even know who this person is. Verse 19, he says, who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have a rule over all my labor wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This was his pride. This was his pleasure. But yet he suddenly realizes that I'm going to leave it to someone else. And this person may not be worthy of these things which I leave him. He's still very much in this world, still very much fixated on the things that he had. And that was his problem. His thinking, his heart, everything about his life was not God-centered. It was worldly, carnally centered. And he was worried about all these things. And for him specifically, it was a very true, or you can say a real concern, right? Because there was this warning and a prophecy which God gave him. Remember in 1 Kings chapter 11, when finally all his sins caught up with him, and then God sent a prophet, a man of God, to tell him, because of the way which you have sinned, because of the way in which we have turned away from God and sought after all these idols and strange women, you're going to have to face this penalty. Your kingdom will be torn away from you, right? And it was visually depicted in the ripping of his garment. One small portion will be for your son, Rehoboam. Right? Rehoboam will just inherit Judah. And the other tribes will all be inherited by this other man, Jeroboam. And perhaps that's what got him thinking. I'm going to die. I'm going to leave this earth. And not even, my son is just going to get a fraction of my kingdom. And everything else is going to someone else. And who is this person? He doesn't deserve my labor. He doesn't deserve my efforts. And what, you mean he is going to inherit everything? And that got him so upset. That got him so troubled. He says, well, who is he? Is he a wise man? Is he a fool? But yet he shall have rule over all my labor. Then verse 20 says, therefore I went to cause my heart to despair. Despair. It was not just that he grieved or he hated. You know, this word despair really carries this idea of hopelessness, isn't it? You despair when there is simply no hope. He says, well, what's the point of living? What's the point of working so hard all my life? What's the point of all these accomplishments? No meaning whatsoever. Why? Because his life, his desires were all centered on the temporal, on the physical. And he says, well, what's the point? Therefore, I went to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. He hated it. Meaningless, useless. Why? Because he says, there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and equity. He's talking about himself, right? I worked hard. I worked fairly. I did everything justly. I worked very hard. I applied my wisdom and my intellect. And I accomplished all these things. But yet to a man that have not labored therein, shall he leave it for his portion? He says, my labor is going to someone else. And this is a great evil and a great vanity. And what hath a man of all his labor and the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This is also vanity. So sad, isn't it, for such an accomplished and great man to descend to such depths of grief and despair. He says, I couldn't even sleep at night. All these worries were just plaguing him. He was so troubled. Why? Because he was going to the wrong place for meaning. As a carnal person, all he could think about was the present, the temporal. All he could think about was the legacy and the remembrance that he'll leave behind. He wanted people to think well of him. And now that he realized his kingdom is going to be torn from him, He says, well, what's the point of all this labor and all my work? Labor is just sorrow. He says, all your days are sorrow. All your days are just travel and grief. A troubling, troubling existence. Why? Because he was still carnal. And his perception of death at this point of time was really just wrong. Wrong. Okay, much later on, he's going to give us the right conclusion. All right, but at this point of time, he's still just recounting his search. He's just telling us of all the wrong alleys that he went down. Tried to search for this, tried to search for that. He poured all his heart into his labor, into his accomplishments, into the things of this life. And then suddenly he hit a wall. And he realized that all these things really, really don't give me meaning, accomplishment, don't give me any fulfillment at all. And sad to say, many of us, many believers, many Christians are still charging down these different alleyways, isn't it? Trying to seek meaning in the things of this world, thinking that their labor is really all that their world is about. They pour all their efforts into it, and they really do find meaning, a sort of a temporal joy, a sort of a thrill, a sort of an excitement in the things that they do, isn't it? In their careers, in their jobs, in their hobbies. And to them, this is the life, isn't it? This is really what brings me meaning and fulfillment and joy. And when I bring home that paycheck, well, there is this indescribable joy in my heart. When I'm told of the promotion, when I'm headhunted to this other firm, wow, the world treasures me, the world values me, and I like it. It's sad to say, many of us are still stuck in this rut. As we think about death, as we think about our life cut short, all we can think about is really my stuff, what happens to it, the things that I've accomplished, to what end, right? My house, I've spent all my life paying it, isn't it? I took a 30-year loan and I have just reached a 29th year and it's going to be mine. And then I got struck down with a sickness, a disease, an illness, a cancer. 6 months left to live? How about this house that I spent all my life paying for? What, you want me to sell it to pay for my medical fee? What? You get so upset, you get so angry, you get so disillusioned with life. And so many people have walked down these pathways, isn't it? Made all these mistakes. And Solomon writes to us to say, please, don't go down these same ways. Don't try to find fulfillment in all these different areas because it just doesn't work. Because time and again, he says, what? This is also vanity. This is vanity and a great evil. This is also vanity. Again and again and again, he just repeats himself. And you realize as you study through the book of Ecclesiastes, he's going to repeat himself again and again and again. Why? Because he just keeps trying to drive home the point to us. Because perhaps he realized how hard it is to grasp this message. It took him a whole lifetime. And he's going to tell us again and again of the vanities, of wealth, of this world, of the treasures, of the temporal things. He's going to try through this whole book to work into us this understanding that you must have God in your life. Because without God, there is simply no meaning at all. As he comes to the end of this chapter, he gives us a sort of a mini conclusion, right? This is not his final conclusion because the final conclusion only comes at the end of the book, right? We all know it. Fear God, keep his commandments, this is the whole duty of man, okay? But at this point of time, not yet. He's trying to work us towards the direction. And, you know, really many of the writings in this book, it can be described as what he would say goads, right? You see that in chapter 12, goads. Pricks that the shepherds would use to prod us in the right direction, right? As a tool of the shepherd. And he says, now, this is what he sought to do in this book. He sought to find these acceptable words, wise words, as goads of a shepherd to prod us in the right direction. And so these are just the first of many, many goads that he would use, right? To push us away from the world and towards God. And so it's a short-term conclusion at this point of time. As he shares his testimony and as he tells us, now, these are all the things that I tried to do. It really did not bring me meaning and fulfillment in life. But, you know, at this point of time, what then shall we do with our life? Yes, we have money, we have wealth, we have accomplishments. What is the right perspective of it? And so he shares with us really the perception of a godly man. Okay, that's what we see in the last three verses from verse 24 to 26. As I said, this is a retrospective look at his life. So he has already went through all these things and he says, at that point of time, I just despaired, right? At that point of time, vanity, vexation of spirit. But then he kind of gives us a caveat at the end of it all and says, now, by the way, don't think that, well, all wealth and all riches and all treasure is just evil. We know that, right? It's not inherently sinful to have these things, to have money and wealth and riches. He says, but if you have these things, or whatever portion that your labor has awarded you, right? We all work and we all have something to varying degrees. Not all of us will be as Solomon. Some of us may come close. But all of us to varying degrees, we have a measure of success in terms of our material possessions. What do we do with it? Verse 24 then instructs us. He says, really, in order not to feel the way that I feel, right, in order not to despair and to grieve and hate life and hate labor, he says, well, there is nothing better, really, for a man that he should eat and drink, and that he should make so enjoy good in his labor. Basically, he's teaching us the principle of contentment here. Okay? It's a theme that he's going to repeat a number of times throughout this book. It's a sort of a mini conclusion as he discusses various aspects of life. He brings us back to this thought of contentment. He says, yes, true, many things are vanity, right? But does it mean that we then just sit back and do nothing? No, we have to labor. But yet the purpose and the object of your labor is not pride, is not your greatness, is not to show off, but simply just, well, to feed yourself. And when he says nothing better, he doesn't mean that this is the absolute best thing. Okay, that's not the meaning here. It's not to say that this is the chief end of man. No, we know that his final conclusion, serve God, fear God, keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. But at this point of time, he's just trying to direct us to the thought or the realization that now when you labor, right? Because previously he said, I hate the labor. That was wrong. He says, no, we labor. Okay? And God is going to grant us things. Right? Verse 26, we just glanced there first. God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. Well, we have these things. Right? We're going to look at the rest of it later. But he says, well, as you labor, as you work hard, you will have things. And to an extent, I mean, all of us are prosperous. You say, oh, I'm not Solomon. I don't have all these things. But well, we are living in a comfortable, prosperous city or country. We work and we have jobs. We never lack for the basic three meals and a roof over our heads. We have these things. And so when you have these things, what do? Do you then look out and imagine what would it be like to have more? Do you worry about, well, how much I don't have or who I'm going to leave it to? He says, no, don't think about all these things. That's not the point. What is the purpose of all the things that you have? Well, it's just what God has given you for this present life, and it's not wrong to enjoy it. Not wrong to enjoy it. Right? He says, well, you just make his soul enjoy good in this labor that you have got. Why do I say this is the thoughts of a godly person? Because for the first time, he brings God into the picture. Verse 24, this also I saw that it was from the hand of God. That is the one thought that we must have in order for our life to have meaning. To realize that in it all, God's hand is there. God's hand is the one that is sovereign over all things. It is God's providential hand that has provided for me, right? Anything that I have, everything that I have, all comes from the hand of God. He is not encouraging us to live this wanton, hedonistic lifestyle, because sometimes that is the phrase, that is what this phrase is associated with, right? Oh, just eat, drink and be merry and then tomorrow we die. That is the wrong perspective. But to say that we should eat and drink because all we have is from the hand of God, that's a good perspective to have, right? To realize that, well, whatever I have, God has given this to me. And therefore, what is the attitude? Contentment, thankfulness, right? Joy, knowing that, well, this is from God, and what can be better than what I have from God? This is the very best because God knows best. He's sovereign. He has a plan for me in my life. He has placed me in this particular job. He has arranged it in such a way that these are the things that I have. Not a penny more, not a penny less. This is exactly what God wants for me. This is what came from the hand of God. And therefore, we just simply be content. We thank God for what He has given to us and we enjoy it. And this phrase, make His soul good, make His soul to enjoy good, right, is different from what He did in the past, right? Where He said, whatever my heart desired, I kept not from them, and I made my heart to rejoice. Now, that was hedonistic. That was this wanton, carnal, worldly way to live. But here, it is qualified by the fact that it is from the hand of God. In a sense, when you realize that what you have is from the hand of God, I mean, that will limit the scope of your so-called enjoyment, wouldn't it? You cannot, on one hand, say, oh, I thank God for giving me all these things. I thank God for giving me this paycheck and this money. And then you go forth and gamble or hire prostitutes. That is not making your soul to enjoy, isn't it? That is clearly sin. But if you clearly recognize that this is from the hand of God, that will limit the scope of all your enjoyment. And the enjoyment that you will then seek after is pure. It is clean. It is sanctified. It is godly. It is holy. And so that is really the scope in which He tells us to be content. Recognize and realize that everything that you have is from the hand of God. And that is the perspective that you must have to everything that you do in this life. And for the godly man, this is the right perspective. Previously, He told us of the carnal perspective, of the dying man's perspective. Now He tells us, now as a godly person with the right godly perspectives in my life, this is how I lived. I saw everything from the hand of God. And He went on to say, who can eat? Who else can hasten thereof more than I? He says, I as king. And I, as the richest man of the region, at a point of time, had everything. No one else could have enjoyed more than me. But then he realized and recognized that everything was under the sovereignty of God. And that is what verse 26 is talking about. The hand of God, right, that he talked about in verse 24, it is further explained to us in verse 26. He says, well, God is the one that gives. He gives to a man that is good in his sight. Wisdom, knowledge, joy. Well, it's up to him. But to the sinner, he gave us travail to gather and to heap up. And he says, well, that was how he was. He was a sinner, and no matter how much he had nothing but sorrow and travail because he had the wrong perspectives. But if you are good in his sight, in the sense that you are godly, you have the right perspectives, God is the one who is able to give you joy. And joy will not come as, directly proportional to the possessions that you have. No. Joy in the sense where God will teach you the right perspectives to have in life. You will know where to find meaning and fulfillment in life because that is a godly person. You know the Word of God. You know the sovereignty of God. You know the hand of God in your life. And then God will teach you, how can I really enjoy life? How can I really have pleasure in this life? Not through the pursuit of all these things. Yes, in the course of your labor, you will be given many of these things, but how you use it, that is key, isn't it? How you perceive them, that is key. Because the godly person will just simply thank God for whatever, whether it be great or small, whether it be much or little. He says, well, God is the one that gives it to me. And to the sinner, God also knows how to punish them, to give them travail, even though they have so much. They gather and heap up, right? That is what the sinner does. It is he gathers and heaps up, but yet to him it is sorrow and travail. But then he can give that to his that he may give to him that is good before God. God can, on one hand, easily just give it to someone else. This is all under the sovereign hand of God, and it's really up to him. It is God's singular prerogative, not up to man. We can't decide who gets what. God alone. And so, what are we to do? Simply just submit to His sovereignty, isn't it? To acknowledge that I can't control this life. I cannot engineer my success or I cannot craft someone else's demise. No, I just simply do my own thing. I labor. I work hard because that is the good testimony that I want to produce. And whatever God gives me, well, I just enjoy. I thank God for it. I don't worry too much about where it's going to go after I die. I don't worry too much about all these different things. I just simply thank God, and then I live life the right way. And it's really, it's just, you can see his mini conclusion, right? Because, of course, there is a lot more to say about this present life and the godly perspective of it. But he will slowly come to it as he works his way through this book, right? Goading us and prodding us towards finally concluding together with him that, yes, many things in this life really don't have meaning. The carnal things of this world, the worldly things, no use. But when we have God in the picture, when we fear God and we keep his commandments, yes, this is the best possible life that we can ever live. And that is really what meaning is. When God is in the picture, that is true meaning and fulfillment for our life in this present. Let's turn to the Lord in prayer. Our Father in heaven, we thank thee for gathering us together. As we look at the life of Solomon, and as we look at the things that he accomplished in his life, help us not to be envious of the material aspect of it, but really to seek after the godly conclusion that he had as well. That in this life, there is nothing better than to thank thee for what we have, to be content and to enjoy the goodness that thou hast given to us. Pray that thou grant us this heart of contentment. Help us to really have the right focus and direction in this life, that our desire for meaning and fulfillment will only be found in thee and not the things of this world. We pray that thou help us. Pray that also guide us through the time of discussion that we will have later on. That will help us also to be able to share and edify and encourage one another through our sharings and through our study of thy word. We thank thee for this time. We commit the rest of this evening to thy hands. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.